This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027.
Well, it's just after 4 minutes past six here on Classic 1027, and time for our special, just under an hour-long debate on the future of healthcare in South Africa. We've had two major developments over the last month that help inform a picture of where we're going. During this state of flux, we've had the NHI and medical schemes bills and the results of the Competition Commission's health market inquiry. And because we're all constitutionalists around the table tonight, or I hope so at least, I'd like to preface the debate with what the Constitution says about realising this progressive right to healthcare. Among other things, Section 27 of the Constitution provides as follows. Every person has the right to have access to healthcare services, including reproductive healthcare, and no person may be refused emergency treatment. In general, the state's positive and negative duties are set out in Section 7.2 of the Constitution, which requires the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfil the rights in the Bill of Rights. In relation to healthcare services, it means the government must respect the right of access to healthcare services by not unfairly or unreasonably getting in the way of people accessing existing healthcare services, whether in the public or the private sector. It must protect the right by developing and implementing a comprehensive legal framework to stop people who get in the way of the existing access of others, and it must fulfill the right by creating the necessary conditions for people to access healthcare by providing positive assistance, benefits, and actual healthcare services. Now, in particular, this section says the government must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve the progressive realization of the right of healthcare. It means taking all reasonable steps to ensure that the right is protected, promoted, and fulfilled, and that over time, this idea of universal access to quality and comprehensive healthcare is achieved. It's a noble aim, and clearly the NHI proposals and the broader health market inquiry must be viewed against this constitutional backdrop. But are the findings and proposals practical? Are they reasonable? Or in some instances, are they even correct, given our fiscal and capacity constraints? So the listeners to this show often email or tweet me and ask me, what is the future of private hospitals or state hospitals in South Africa? What is the future of private medical schemes? What's going to happen, importantly, to the quality of care? Is the quality going to go down the tubes? I think that scares a lot of people. Well, to debate this, let's welcome tonight's panelists. First up, and in no specific order here, is Roly Bass, Head of Funder Relations at Mediclinic. Evening, Roly.
Good evening to you.
Mike Stowe, CEO of Hold Consulting, an actuary working in the pensions medical scheme space, is also on the line. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Michael. Good evening, and good evening, listeners.
Also on the line is Dr. Brian Ruff, CEO of PPO Serve. Brian, I'm sorry you couldn't come into studio tonight, but thanks for joining us anyway.
Thanks for having me again, Michael.
And Dr. Jonathan Broomberg, the CEO of Discovery Health, who is also on the line. Dr. Broomberg, thanks for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Looking forward to the debate.
And at least I'm not lonely in studio. One person in studio tonight, Dr. Johan Serfontein, a senior consultant at HealthMan. Dr. Serfontein, always a pleasure.
Good evening, Michael, and good evening to the listeners.
Now, Brian, kick us off here. The health market inquiry found that private healthcare in South Africa is characterized by a disempowered and uninformed consumer, and also characterized by medical schemes that are difficult to understand, which is hard to disagree with. There's a plethora of them out there, and sometimes comparing them means you need a bit of an actuarial degree. Among the report's major provisional recommendations were that medical schemes be simplified so that we can understand them, we can make comparisons, and that a regulatory authority should be established for effective and efficient oversight of the supply side of this market. What did you make of the HMI's findings and those two proposals in particular?
In general, I'm very impressed. I think they've done a very good and thorough piece of work, and they've obviously done a lot of analysis. And I think they've found the major problems in the current sector and why it produces such suboptimal outcomes. So I was very impressed. I mean, in particular, I think to come to those two issues, they identify the fact that people don't make a choice of what scheme to join on the basis of how well that scheme is using its purchasing power to buy quality care at the lowest possible costs, and that if schemes were in fact competing largely on that basis, that the supply side would be would probably be a great deal more effective. And they also made the point that on the supply side, there's almost no data, there's no information. The basis on which licenses for hospitals are given is irrational. And so it's a system that's operating in which accountants know what's happening, but pretty much nobody else. And so these are the two right points to identify, and these are probably the right kind of interventions that they've recommended.
Dr. Broomberg, surely medical aid schemes can be simplified to ensure easier comparison. I mean, what do you make of that recommendation?
Michael, you know, they can be simplified to an extent. One area I certainly agree with is that they are complex and that the average consumer struggles to understand how they operate. What we strongly disagree with is the implication, and actually the statement by the HMI, that this is somehow deliberate. If you actually study the multiplicity of medical scheme options out there, you'll find that they vary between each other across quite a few fairly simple metrics in the first instance. Do they have a savings account or not? Is it a hospital plan only or not? Are there deductibles, co-payments on certain procedures or not? Where things get very complicated is the rules that medical schemes have in place, mainly to comply with some of the regulations, for example, around so-called prescribed minimum benefits. And so a very big driver of complexity is regulation. And actually, I think, one could summarize just in a line or two the entire health market inquiries. I agree with Brian, very insightful report, which is that we're dealing with a complex and incomplete and in many respects irrational regulatory framework, and that making a few significant changes to that framework, as the HMI panel recommended, could make a huge difference both to consumer transparency and understanding, but more importantly to the cost and quality of healthcare. It doesn't help to say that there are actors in the system that are deliberately doing things to confuse people. That's not the case.
The head of the commission, the chairman of the commission, former Chief Justice Sandile Ngcobo, was quoted as saying that under normal competitive conditions, Discovery's profitability would attract new competitors and stimulate competition from incumbents. And he said they're not picking up any signs of this. Why is it that it's a market that seems to be dominated by just a couple of schemes?
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. And, I think that, in my view, comes straight back to regulation. There are regulations that make it very difficult for a new medical scheme to be established. The entire structure of the Medical Schemes Act specifies that medical schemes are not-for-profit entities that have to have some quite significant startup capital. And who's going to put up startup capital for a not-for-profit entity? So that's the first question. Then you have this requirement for an arm's-length contract with the administrator. Those are for-profit. But if they're at arm's length from a medical scheme, they've got no incentive to put up the startup capital. So I could go on for in detail, but the basic point that the HMI, I think, has identified here is that there are actually quite significant barriers to entry, both for administrators of medical schemes and for schemes, and that making those barriers lower could encourage new schemes to enter. And that would be good for competition, and I think we would welcome that. What we didn't welcome is, in a sense, fingers being pointed at the success story in the industry as if somehow we are to blame for the lack of competition. That doesn't make any sense at all.
And you know, one can certainly point to the regulatory complexity all across the health care sector. It is one of the things that Ngobo referenced, the fact that government, if it was actually following through on its own health act, might not find itself in this particular position. Rowley, you're head of funder relations at MediClinic, and the report was also critical of the three large hospital groups and basically said we've got some supply-induced demand driving up costs, perhaps too many hospital beds and also doctors willing to over-test in this environment. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think we have to give cognizance of the fact that the panel is looking at a very complex issue in terms of health supply. I don't think it's as simple as what is being portrayed in the report. At the moment, if you look at how they've got to supply and induced demand, they start off with the understanding that costs have escalated by, for example, 10% this year. They then deduct CPI, and they make some form of adjustment for what they call age and disease profiles and the rest of it. And then whatever gets left behind is considered the unexplained and therefore the supply and induced demand. And then we start to make all the assumptions that go from that. What is particularly disturbing about that particular sum that gets made is that if you don't look at overseas analysts that look at this kind of question, they'd be looking at two very important areas that have been left out of the calculation. The one is the cost of new technology. And if you go and look at the overseas comparisons that get done, you'll find that new technology accounts for at least about 0.5% every year of the cost increase. And the other one that's particularly important is the cost of human capital in the health supply chain. And it's at least 50 to 60% of all costs are related to some form of salary, if you understand what I'm suggesting. Now, there's a report by the Health Systems Trust in 2017, which reflects on the government's salary increase and talks to a period of somewhere between 5 and 8 years. And they point out that the government's increases in salaries for health professionals only, we're not talking admin people, is 4.5% more than CPI in every year, consecutively in every year. And so if you were to do that exact same sum that they've done, but you'd allow for a proper medical price inflation, and you allow for some degree of cost that's due to new health technologies, then the balance that gets left behind is actually relatively small. So I'm not saying that there isn't supply-induced demand. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying I think what's happening at the moment is that we are not having a comprehensive enough calculation being done. And I suggest that we are making assumptions from that which are not quite relevant today.
Mm. And perhaps, as you're stating, that the amount of supply-induced demand is inflated, taking into account technology and cost of human capital. Dr. Broomberg, just to bounce it back to you, though, I know the medical schemes have been fairly critical of the large hospital groups in the past, though, for supply-induced demand.
Yeah, I think that, there's no doubt, as Rowley said, that it exists. We think it is a material problem in the country. I tend to agree with Rowley that the calculations are not entirely accurate. Supply-induced demand comes from all parts of the supply chain. It comes from hospitals, mainly in the sense of new beds, being opened often in areas that are already over-traded. It comes from health professionals who, because they possess much more information than their patients, are able to induce demand for their services, pretty much like a lawyer can or other professionals where there's an asymmetry of information. It also comes from the suppliers of equipment and pharmaceuticals who are good at inducing demand for their products. So this is a well-known phenomenon of healthcare systems globally. It's not unique to South Africa. But it is something that we have to tackle. And I think, this is where Brian is pointing towards realigning incentives and payment systems. And maybe we can spend a bit of time talking about that so that you can effectively remove the incentives for most of the supply-induced demand.
Brian, I'm going to bounce the ball back to you. We're not going around the table as I had hoped, but let's just flow with the conversation here. How does your model, which is all about getting economies of scale and getting doctors to work in bigger groups and units, a model that will help bring down costs and start to get ahead of the supply-induced demand problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is clearly a problem of general over-servicing, but it's particularly bad in our hospital sector. And really, I'm not pointing fingers. I'm simply saying is that our benefit structures and the way that we pay people has created a situation where, in fact, the services that are available in the community, in out-of-hospital areas, is so weak that we end up doing a whole lot of work in hospitals that actually could and should have been done in the rooms of doctors or in day facilities or rehab facilities of various kinds. And I think the point that Johnny's alluding to and that you're alluding to is that it is quite possible, in fact, in most countries in the world, there is a great deal more money spent on supporting primary care centers, out-of-hospital centers, integrated multidisciplinary teams. And if you pay people to work together in teams and you pay for those services out of hospital, that in fact it's very much better care for patients. It's much more cost effective and it produces much better outcomes. So our model works. I'm actually standing in Alberton at the moment because we have a multidisciplinary team meeting this evening that happens on a routine basis in which we get there's a team of doctors who own a business. It's their own business. We just support it. But they get specialists and general practitioners and allied health professionals and a whole lot of nurses who work in a team together. And this evening they get together and they talk about really complex clinical and social problems that these patients have. And together they plan proactive care plans into the future and they review what's happened to patients that we've talked about before. And there's a kind of constant iterative process of achieving better care. And it's really, these meetings are fantastic and the process is fantastic. It's so unusual in the private sector to be exposed to that kind of integrated teamwork. And we have a similar model that applies to maternity care, obstetricians and midwives working together where the obstetrician becomes, in a sense, the team leader and the consultant rather than having an individual relationship with every patient. Then you get to a position where an obstetrician, instead of being involved in maybe 12 or 13 deliveries in a month, is in fact involved in a team that's maybe doing 200 or 300 deliveries every month, and again through a process of teamwork is involved in quality assurance and routine review of the data to drive continuous improvement. So it's eminently doable. But I think where Johnny's taking us is that you've got to pay those teams to work as teams and you have to give them some kind of recognition of the outcomes they produce, and then I think all of that follows.
And then we can do that at scale. Dr. Serpentine, just to bring you into the conversation now, having listened to the opening comments so far on the HMI, what was your view on the findings of the HMI?
I think in the end, we didn't get anything that was a surprise. A lot of people in the industry kind of had a good idea of what was going on in the industry, so there isn't something that popped out as totally unexpected. The question, of course, is what is going to happen with these recommendations? Because you're sitting in a situation where we've got the National Health Insurance Bill that came out, the Medical Schemes Amendment Bill. They didn't seem to consider the HMI report that came out. So the question is, are they going to be considering it going forward? And there's no legal principle for, you know, it's not enforceable, it's recommendations. So one has to wonder if it doesn't please the minister, you know, whether he is going to actually implement all of it or not. And we'll have to wait and see how much political will there is to implement the HMI findings. Because if you have a private sector that suddenly becomes more functional and starts getting more affordable, you know, then half of the need for NHI is suddenly missing, because it's always been there's a problem with quality in the public sector and the private sector is too expensive. So suddenly if the private sector is now more affordable, you know, then what, you know, the whole rhetoric changes in extent.
And the whole contracting model of the NHI might put large swathes of the public sector out of business, effectively, with that centralized fund. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. Mike, overall, what did you think of the HMI's findings?
My impression was that it was pretty accurate within the confines of its view of purely the private sector. Unfortunately, I think largely irrelevant. The minister, Dr. Motsoaledi, in his reaction said there was nothing new, and yet I think although both the inquiry and his bill allow for comment to be made over the course of the next month or so, he clearly has dismissed out of hand, I think, some very important differences between what the inquiry says. And there were three key findings. In inquiry, the first one was to change the way scheme options are structured, and that way was to increase comparability, reduce the number of options, making PNB and expanding PNB, whereas the minister proposes, as I'm sure Dr. Jonathan Broomberg would agree, to abolish PNB. I and many clients wouldn't like to see that happen. The second, I think, big point was to propose that there should be increased transparency, that patients at the moment, consumers, do not know not only pricing, but they don't know how good a doctor or hospital is. And it would be really useful if existing laws that are in place were enforced. And in fact, there has been enormous, in my opinion, regulatory failure by the Council for Medical Schemes to enforce laws which it is obliged to do. And none strikes me more forcibly than its failure to enforce PNB unless a rare informed member of the public claims his rights. And I think the third finding as well was completely contrary to what the minister intends doing, which is to say that it should put in place a competitive market. I don't think the minister wants any markets. The minister has in mind a prescriptive centralized Politburo where he dictates and sets about spending money for which he has no source. And the market inquiry was very different. It proposed a risk equalization fund. It proposed a means of funding these benefits. And it noted very specifically that the amounts that the government currently spends per capita in the public sector on public health, in our failed hospitals, public hospitals, is in fact more than the tax credit allowed to members of private medical schemes. So far from being a complete market failure, I would say the elephant in the room is the failure of the Department of Health.
I think we've just had an interruption on the line, unfortunately, as you were getting right into it there, Mike. So, Dr. Broomberg, I'm going to bounce the ball back to you, following on the comments from Mike Stowe there, particularly around medical schemes. And for me, the big issue, if you look at it, the impact of the proposed NHR on medical schemes is fairly predicted. I mean, the bills recently introduced by the minister, as he said, are going to be dramatic. The primary impact of the NHI bill is to create a basket of benefits or health goods that are going to be available to all South Africans, whether you're a member of a medical scheme or not. We don't know the actual elements of the basket because they're going to be set out in regulations that we're still waiting for. But it does leave medical schemes in a position where they'll have to decide either to redesign their benefits to take into account of these services offered by NHI or not. So what is the consequence of this for medical schemes going forward?
Mike, I think that is the, you know, that's the key question from our point of view. And I think it's the way we are reading the bills and, you know, conversations with policymakers and others, I think make it very clear to us that that for as long into the future as all of us can be planning, medical schemes are likely to continue, I would say, very much in similar form to how they do now, alongside this very slowly emerging NHI. And I think, you know, the anxiety and panic that some people have experienced in relation to some of the media reports is misplaced. If you read the NHI bill, there are a few clauses in there that I think are very important for your listeners to understand. A key one says that if you want benefits from the NHI, so let's take the example of a pregnant woman who wants to have a delivery, the clause says that if you want that covered by the NHI, you need to follow the NHI's, as they call it, referral pathways, i.e. you must come to our clinics with our contracted providers, if we have any, or our government clinics, and you know, we will do all the antenatal care and we'll do the delivery. We'll refer you to a local hospital if you're complicated. But only if you do that can you claim. It then goes on to say, if you choose not to do that and you choose to go to your own obstetrician or to a team that's run by PPO, Sir Brian's company in the private sector, then you can't claim from the NHI. And it goes on to say that you can either pay for it yourself or claim from your medical aid or other health insurance. And the way we read that is actually very clear, which is that there is really no world in the long-term future where this NHI is going to crowd out medical schemes from doing what they currently do.
Dr. Broomberg, sorry, I have to interject just because we have to break for the news wrap at 6:30, but I'd like you to continue when we return. Let's cross now to the news desk. Pusuletso Peterson standing by.
Michael Avery with Classic Business on Classic 1027.
Welcome back to the big healthcare debate here on Classic Business, where we're talking about the future of healthcare in South Africa following the introduction of two bills to herald the introduction into law of the NHI and, of course, the findings of the Health Market Inquiry. I did find it very curious that the bills were introduced a matter of weeks before the Health Market Inquiry. Surely that could have waited and taken all of that work into account. But be that as it may, it didn't. And here we are. Jonathan Broomberg, the CEO of Discovery Health, you were explaining how the medical schemes will continue to exist alongside an NHI system. And unfortunately, I had to rather rudely interrupt you for the 6:30 news wrap. But my issue that that's all good and well, but aren't the proposals therefore just creating a system where the very wealthy and the very upper income earners in South African society, so the 3-4% of South Africans are going to now be funding an NHI, and also they're then going to have to fund their own private medical schemes as well, because not many of them are going to go the NHI route if they can just bypass all of those channels and go directly through their schemes. Dr. Broomberg? I think we've lost.
Can you hear me?
There we go. We've got you back. Did you hear my question?
I heard your question. Yep. And I think the important point I wanted to make in response is that actually, you know, as we are today, the tax-paying base of this country, roughly 5 or 6 million households, is already paying twice. We are all paying for private health care, most of it after tax. Money for our premiums, although there is a tax credit, as we know. But also we're paying through income tax and VAT and company tax, etc. We're funding the entire budget of the public healthcare system, which, you know, is heading towards around $200 billion a year. And I think what's important to bear in mind here is that the clear signal from the Treasury is that there is not significant additional funding available to go beyond the current already fairly generous public health budget. The Minister of Finance in the last budget speech allocated 4 billion rand for the next 3 years. So that's 1.5 billion a year or a little less. And if in the context of a 200 billion a year budget, you get a sense of what kind of funds are available. And given, you know, our economic situation, given the other demands for taxes, etc. You know, we don't anticipate Treasury massively increasing tax rates or creating dedicated taxes in the foreseeable future for this NHI. It's going to be a marginal incremental expansion of the public health system for the foreseeable future, as far as we can tell.
And Dr. Serfontaine, if you look at it, tax credits, just to pick up on that one point, they might be considered part of the public funding environment. Government contributions to the private medical schemes of employees is surely an employee benefit, not public funding. And if you look at it, private contributions by individuals or their employers to private schemes aren't part of public funding, and therefore the reserves held by medical schemes are subsequently also not part of that that public funding pot. So where will the money come from if not from huge tax increases?
Yeah, that is an important question. I think one of the misnomers that the minister likes to use is that, you know, the 8.5% of GDP that gets spent on healthcare, you know, and he reckons that half of that is spent on the private sector and only 16% of people covered. And the fact is, you know, and he wants that whole pot available for everybody to equalize the spend, sort of. The concern is that private sector spend is private money. If you take the 20-odd billion of tax credits out of the picture, and everybody in the private sector today stops paying for their medical scheme, the state sector would have an additional 8.8 million patients that it needs to cover, and the funding would not increase by a single cent. Because it's discretionary spend on the part of private individuals to pay for their private health care. And if they stop doing that, the money doesn't suddenly become available to the state to include in the budget. And even the 20 billion in tax credits might not be available for health care spend, because it'll go into a common fiscus and we've got enough holes to plug that it might not even end up in health. And then, of course, there's the additional 30 or 35 billion rand that the state pays as an employment perk for government employees to belong to medical schemes. Now, I don't think for one single moment that the unions are going to allow for that money to be taken away from their members. So they, if that falls away for some reason, they are going to demand that in cash. So that money is not going to be available to the fiscus either. So we're going to have a big funding problem. If you look at a 1% increase in VAT, it gave us an additional 20 billion rand. You know, initial indications are that we might have 150 billion shortfall on NHI funding, which means a kind of a 7.5% VAT increase, or the equivalent in personal income tax or company tax. So it really creates a lot of questions as to where the funding for this project is going to come from.
And no ready answers. Brian, do you have any ideas on how the NHI might be funded?
Yeah, I think that there's a different way of framing this question that is perhaps not quite as what you might call scaremongering as what we've been listening to the last few minutes. So I think if you're the Minister of Health or if you're any government, you know that at the end of the day, it's not really in the interest of the country to have this split health system, public system and a private system, that ultimately you must be interested in convergence. We know a unitary system is much better for the political and economic health of a country, for the development of the country. And so if I was the Minister of Health, the way I'm thinking about it, it's much less about the amount of money that is spent in the respective systems. And also I know that I get very poor value for money in the public sector as well as in the private sector. So what it's really about is, in fact, it's about resources. If you think about South Africa as a whole, in terms of all the hospital beds and all the doctors, as a whole, for the 55 million, the ratios that we've got are okay. They're not bad at all. They're not excessive. The problem is that we only, the scheme and some cash-paying patients, have access to a huge number of those resources. So the question for him is, how do I start creating this convergence? And I think if you start thinking about that, there's a very different way. And if you also understand that this government looks to the UK NHS for models, you'll remember that 15 years ago or so, the NHS did some experimentation. Some South African hospital groups participated in this, particularly Medcare and Life Healthcare, and they started creating what they call choice. So they got essentially private hospitals to do, I think it was orthopedic surgery and cataract surgery in private facilities for publicly funded patients. And the real idea, I think, at the end of the day, was to give a big fright to the managers of the public hospital, saying, if you guys don't use the public money properly, there is an alternative. So if you know, and Johnny knows about this, in the last couple of years, the National Department has started using its own money to start getting private practitioners, and now is starting to invite a whole range of private facilities to help the government to get rid of its backlogs. And there's a tender out for quite a lot of money to help them do that. There's another new tender that the National Department has put out, which asks universities to come in and help them set up a whole range of essentially private primary care centers to deliver, again, services using public money for non-scheme members, I would guess, as well as obviously if scheme members want to use it. But again, trying to create these kind of this a new converging and mixed system. And to build, I think, on what Johnny was saying, I think the schemes are, and the administrators of the schemes are going to pile into this work. They're going to be saying, great, if there's a new source of funding and we can use our management experience to be able to support models that deliver well on this mandate, and it's not our scheme's money, and we can learn how to do this, we're happy to go along with that. If the universities can learn how to do that, all the better. So I have a much more positive view. I think we're going along a policy road to some kind of convergence, and I think what it also looks like is the unit costs that we're experiencing in the private sector and the over-servicing all result in these unbelievably high scheme premiums, which, as you know, is taking sometimes 20% more of people's monthly payments, what they earn, out of their pockets. Getting into a model in which you could do so much more with so much less money. So I have a much more sanguine view, but I think the only way that it happens is if we don't carry on just complaining, but we actually get involved in the process and see what we can do to make this work.
And Johnny, I'm going to bounce it back to you in a second, but not before I get a comment from Rowley, as the hospital representative on the panel. Rowley, what role do you see the hospitals in the country playing to help the public sector? Because if you look at it, only 5 out of, 696, call it 700, public healthcare facilities were in compliance with the norms and standards of the Office of the Health Standards Compliance in the last financial year, and they do regular inspections. If you extrapolate those results, only 25 out of 3,500 public health facilities would currently qualify to contract with the NHI fund. So it implies that unless the government takes serious steps to improve the quality of the public sector right now, there won't be sufficient facilities available to contract with the NHI fund to render services to patients in the NHI. So there's a role here for some positive competition to help improve public healthcare facilities. What sort of conversations are you having with government at the moment to play that role in the spirit of seeing convergence and seeing an opportunity?
I think there really is an opportunity in the long term. We're talking about a real change in thinking. We're talking to a process called the continuum of care, about a connectivity, because much of what Brian has referred to as supply-induced demand is really a consequence of fragmentation in the market. And I think if you look at the HMI report, there's a lot of positive recommendations to how we can go about putting a continuum of care model in place, changing the ethical rules, making it possible for people to actually work together in a very positive way to achieve a result. I think the other one is that I think private hospitals have for a long time been measuring quality, doing quality evaluations, and so on. Unfortunately, we don't in South Africa have a standard. We don't have a norm to measure. If I take sort of analogy which is off the charts and I say to you, we're going to publish the results of a 100-meter race in time, but I don't tell you whether it's for age 10 to 20 or over 65, then the numbers that go out are meaningless and they're not comparable. So there are various steps that have to come into place over time to actually make this new model, this new way of thinking, this new connectivity, continuum of care model work properly. And so we're very positive about that kind of model. We believe it's the right way to go over a long term. We have had meetings with the government. We've looked to see and to ask them, and there's been engagements in small pockets to say if they have a waiting list of cataract operations or a waiting list of hip and knees in a particular province, can we help them work that out? That has been very small. It's been very small initiatives. It's a process of learning, getting to trust one another. And that's the sort of thing that can start and actually get the ball rolling quite quickly and could be a way for us to get to where we have to be over time. So I really believe that the private healthcare sector, and I'm talking generally on the supply side, doctors, nurses, hospitals, the allied professions, all of them, have an ability to make a considerable contribution towards the bigger picture. But I do think we need some of these legislative and regulatory impediments that have been in the way in the past to be removed quite quickly, and then we'd be able to actually get there relatively fast as well.
Dr. Broomberg, on that point, what are the key regulatory impediments now to start achieving what Rolly was talking about there, and to start ensuring that we bring the cost of healthcare down for all South Africans?
Mike, just before I answer that question, I want to just pick up on one of the comments Brian made, which is, you know, labeling what some of mine and Johan's remarks as scaremongering. I don't think that's the point at all. Really, what my intention is to reassure people that these fears that your medical aid is going to disappear and be taken over and you're going to be paying three times are misplaced fears, and that people should actually be more positive about the NHI as an incremental convergence, as Brian says, that can add to the quality and accessibility of healthcare, you know, principally for the poor in the first instance, but over time for more and more people in the country. So it's not scaremongering. I think we're trying to be realistic and say, A, there's not a huge amount of money to add to the current pot, and B, as far as we can tell, medical schemes will continue alongside. So I just wanted to emphasize that point. I think it's very important. On the regulatory issues, there are a few, and the HMI, to their credit, identified the key ones. One of them that's key, is the Health Professions Council, which regulates doctors and other health professionals, has in place a set of what it calls ethical rules that constrain the ability of doctors and other health professionals to work together in teams, to bill collectively through some kind of global fee or other arrangement. And that is a dead hand on supply-side innovation. They also, those rules prevent doctors from working for or being employed by corporations, which might include hospitals, or by other doctors for that matter. So there's a tremendous set of, I would argue, very outdated ethical rules that urgently require complete revision, and the HMI is very clear in making that recommendation. I think if you change that, you'd immediately unleash a huge amount of innovation in the way doctors and hospitals and other providers can start working together. So that's one set. I do think a second is around the licensing of new hospitals and facilities. Out of control as far as we're concerned. Different provinces are just issuing licenses left, right, and center. And your listeners will be interested to know that in the last 2 years, since the beginning of 2016, we are now paying claims from about 2,500 new beds in new facilities that were not existent in our environment pre-January 2016. And that number, it took 10 years before 2016 for the number of beds to increase by 2,500. So it's been an explosion of new beds. It's out of control. It's a huge contributor to increased costs, and that's another issue. And a third is really whether we can bring some order to how the fees that are charged by health professionals are negotiated. At the moment, I think that needs, you know, doctors feel underpaid, there's a lot of variability, members end up with co-payments, and so they do make, we think, some sensible, if complex, proposals on how to bring some order to that environment.
Mike, haven't forgotten about you as we reach the end of our panel here. I think one of the critical elements of the whole NHI system is going to be the benefits it provides, but the bill provides no detail on these benefits, so there's still some major uncertainty here.
Well, I think there's it's really an outline without any content at all, and I think, as Jonathan rightly says, is that there's not much money going around to change the picture at all. So I think that the primary care that is in place could perhaps be improved and perhaps expanded in some way by contracting in private providers, as is beginning to happen. But I think many of the stated objectives are simply wishful thinking. There's no means of obtaining them. And that, in fact, there are much more pressing and urgent things referred to in the inquiry which are not addressed at all in the Medical Schemes Amendment Bill. And one of those is tariffs. I think tariffs and the fact that every single medical scheme has got a different tariff for the same consultation, in effect by law, is absurd and is not assisting at all in pricing or competition. I think certainly the way schemes are designed, the options are structured, and PMEs need urgent attention, and we need more transparency. There are many things that Jonathan has referred to. They've all been laid up there, and I think the Minister of Health has jumped the gun completely with drafting legislation which misses the point. So I'm not at all impressed by having an NHI which has no content, and I don't think it's helpful to anyone.
And it just leads to further speculation, and perhaps, Brian, some of that scaremongering is found in that vacuum. But Dr. Serpentine, just to end off on a point here that that you've actually raised with me in the past, what effect will an NHI actually have on employment in South Africa? And there's this question of contracting service providers to the NHI fund in an area of oversupply, meaning that one of those service providers might have to close down or shut its doors. So there are big employment implications.
Yeah, the employment issue is something that I don't think the unions in South Africa have actually picked up on, because if you look at the function of the Department of Health as it's set, the provincial departments as it's set out in the NHI white paper, all of the hospitals that currently fall under the provincial departments are going to contract directly with the NHI fund, and primary care is going to fall down into a district, a contracting unit for primary health care. So if the provincial departments, and of course your procurement is also going to be centralized to the NHI fund, so if your provincial department suddenly doesn't have to administer any of those functions anymore, one has to wonder what happens to those employees that are employed by the provincial departments of health in an administration role when the administration portion is now getting substantially less. So that's the one aspect. And the other aspect is, yes, if you have a competition between private facilities and public facilities in an area to contract with the NHI fund, and I mean, if you're looking at Joburg and Pretoria and those kind of places, there's quite a concentration of facilities. It is going to be happening on quality. And if the state facility is not got the best quality in that area, you might find that they aren't being contracted with the NHI fund. There will be no provincial provision to pay those staff members anymore in the budget. And you could find that suddenly you've got a hospital with a whole lot of personnel that have to be let go. So the healthcare personnel might get taken up in other facilities, but you'll find a lot of clerks and administrative related people that might not be taken up. And you have to wonder whether this has been considered by the unions, who are quite adamant that they're very supportive of NHI, and yet it could have a major employment effect on their members.
Because a service provider, a practitioner, a doctor, could certainly just follow where the supply is needed, but you can't uproot an entire hospital. Rowley, to come back to you, on that issue of the explosion in beds, I mean, 2,500 beds in the last 2 years, where previously that would take around 10, as Dr. Broomberg said, surely that does speak to a hospital sector that is running rampant.
I don't think we must say the hospital sector is running rampant. I think what we have, and Johnny alluded to it, is the fact that we have a very poor regime in terms of the licensing, the granting of the licenses. So we have, for example, in the Western Cape, there's a R187, and the rest of it, there's another regulation that applies to most of the provinces. We find that in certain provinces, licenses are being issued left, right, and center, in others, not at all. In some provinces, there's a moratorium, in others, there's not. So the fact of the matter is you want to have a system where there's a very clear protocol. On what basis will licenses be issued? On what basis will extensions to hospitals be issued? And if that is set out clearly and there's a very clear guideline as to what are the requirements for licensing and for beds, then we won't end up where we are now. So I do believe that there's a problem with the volume of licenses that are being issued, but I suggest it's more to do with the regulatory space problem than it actually is to do with the licenses. I think if we had that properly sorted out, we might find there'd be a lot less licenses approved and possibly in a greater dispersion over the areas, in rural areas and so on, versus where they are right now. And so again, I come back to, I'm saying if the regulatory part is fixed up, a lot of our problems go away.
And as we saw from the Health Market Inquiry, one of their suggestions was to impose a moratorium on issuing licenses specifically to the three large hospital groups. Interesting to see how that might play out. Brian, just in conclusion, your vision and the way you framed it as a way for these two systems, these two worlds to start to converge and find each other. Are you confident that we're on that path and with the current plans on the table that we'll achieve that lofty aim?
I'm confident that the framework, which is not a uniquely South African framework, but you know, very much a tried and tested international one on the path towards universal healthcare, is the right framework. I'm only confident that it'll happen if we all roll up our sleeves and get involved. And that means that the funders, the schemes, all the state, as well as the doctors and the hospitals, we need to learn together. How do we create high-functioning systems based on teams that are able to do proactive care, not just the reactive stuff we all do at the moment, and that we're involved in continuous improvement? If we do that together, I'm pretty sure it'll happen.
And we can start to breathe some life into that constitutional progressive right of universal access to quality healthcare. While you're down in Alberton, you might want to pop into the union and say hi to one of my doctors who delivered me four decades ago. But that is what we're talking about. We're talking about giving every South African an opportunity to have that basic human right. And hopefully we can find our way through all of this complexity. Thank you very much for my panelists' contributions tonight. Dr. Brian Ruff, CEO of PPOServe, Mike Stowe, the CEO of Whole Consulting, Roly Bass, the head of funder relations at Mediclinic, Dr. Jonathan Broomberg, CEO of Discovery Health, and Dr. Johan Serfontein here in studio, senior healthcare consultant at Healthman.